there is a whole vast universe of wisdom and knowledge which is being exchanged in these conversations. In one of these conversations, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked by his companion to talk about the qualities of a bad friend. It's very interesting. In today's world, 1,400 years later, we find that making friends and keeping friends is one of the most critical things which happens in the life of every individual. The kind of friends you have really influence your decisions and influence your life. If you have good friends, by the will and grace and favor of Allah, you have a higher probability of being good. But if, God forbid, for some reason, you have bad friends, there is a much higher probability that you will be bad. I mean, so if you're raised with killers and criminals and robbers and druggies and alcoholics, the chances are that's what you're going to turn out to be. But on the other hand, if you grow up in a good environment, a good family, no drugs, no alcohol, no lies, no bad stuff, right? You grow up in a religious environment, a pious environment, then the chances are that you will also turn out to be good. Of course, by the will and the grace and the blessings of Allah. So talking about the bad friend, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies, the friend who takes care of you when you are rich but abandons you when you are poor is a bad friend. Isn't this what we see sometimes? And isn't this what we have witnessed in our lives? That when we had wealth and money and power and fame and glory, and we had, you know, cars and houses, and we were eating at great restaurants, then these certain people, they were our best friends, enjoying all the pleasures when we had all the wealth. But when the wealth ran out, and the power and the money and the glory and the fame ran out, and we didn't have too much in our pocket, we could no longer afford to go to those expensive fancy restaurants or drive in expensive cars or go to expensive places, when we weren't able to do this, well, that friend ran out on us. That friend forgot us. That friend abandoned us. This, dear friends, is not a good friend. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented in order for the Muslim community on all levels. All Muslims agree on the Qur'an. And they should. This is the word of God. Everyone, refer to the Qur'an. Any difference, refer to the Qur'an. The Qur'an has guidance in it. If anything is attributed to the Prophet, if it doesn't match the Qur'an, if it conflicts with the Qur'an, contradicts the Qur'an, that's not what the Prophet has said. And if we do that, we said not enough is available to us from the sayings of the Imams. That's true. But the Word of God is available to us. The problem on that one is we didn't go to it. referring to it. The Quran does have a right on the Day of Judgment to say, we didn't go to it. Which of us goes to the Quran? Even those of us who perhaps have memorized the Quran, we don't refer to the Quran. It's not about memorizing the words of the Quran only. And I'm bragging about, I've memorized the Quran, I can read this backwards and this way and that way and skip a verse and flip to this page and so on and so forth. So what? What's your understanding of the Quran? This is the book of not riddles, not games. This is the book of guidance. What guidance did you take from it? If you learned it for riya, you didn't learn a word of it. Memorize the entirety of the Quran. So what, you memorize the entirety of the Quran? Who says it's important to memorize the Quran in that way? What we have is to preserve the Quran. Part of that is just for some to memorize the Quran. But preserving it more than memorizing the words is preserving the meaning within you and implementing it and getting it out, all of us knowing that. That's what preservation of the Quran is. Hifz of the Quran. We just say, oh, hifz means memorization. Who says hifz means memorization? Preserve the Quran. Yes, if you have that talent, you have the time, the right time, that's fine. But that's not what that is emphasizing. What it's emphasizing is preserve the meanings of the Quran in your mind, in the community, in society.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Food production causes 30% of greenhouse gas emissions, and previous studies have shown that meat eating in rich countries must be sharply reduced in order to tackle the climate crisis, largely caused by the methane and deforestation associated with cattle. We're prepared for you an article written by Damien Carrington. The piece is titled, Study Finds Men's Meat-Heavy Diets Cause 40% More Climate Emissions Than Women's. According to a United Kingdom study, men's meaty diets are responsible for 40% more climate heating emissions than those of women. The research also found a quarter of diet-related emissions were from optional food and drink, such as coffee, cakes, and sweets. The scientists said policies to encourage sustainable diets should focus on plant-based foods, but switching drinks and cutting down on sweet snacks presented further opportunities. A second study found in Western countries, vegan and vegetarian diets were about a third cheaper to buy than regular diets, which the researchers said contrasted with a perception that they were the preserve of a privileged middle class. Food production causes 30% of greenhouse gas emissions, and previous studies have shown that meat eating in rich countries must be sharply reduced in order to tackle the climate crisis, largely caused by the methane and deforestation associated with the cattle. But these studies have looked at the average emissions of broad food categories. The new study, published in the journal PLOS ONE, analyzed the emissions linked to more than 3,200 specific food items and examined the diets of 212 British people who recorded their food and drink intake over three 24-hour periods. It found animal products were responsible responsible for almost half of the average diet's greenhouse gas emissions, 31% from meat and 14% from dairy products. Drink caused 15% of emissions, and 8% came from cakes, biscuits, and confectionery. The research also showed that non-vegetarian diets created 59% more emissions than vegetarian diets. Men's diets had 41% more emissions, largely due to eating more meat, but also due to more drinks. Scientists led by Holly Rippin from the University of Leeds in England said, "We all want to do our bit to help save the planet," adding, "Working out how to modify our diets is one way we can do that. There are broad brush concepts like reducing our meat intake, particularly red meat. But our work also shows that big gains can be made from small changes, like cutting out sweets." Holly Rippin from University of Leeds said, "The research did not assess why men ate more meat, but she said, we can speculate that it could be because men generally eat more food than women," adding, "We could also speculate that men may eat more traditional meat-based diets." Another recent study found that men's spending on goods caused 16% more emission than women's, despite the sum of money being very similar, mostly due to higher spending on petrol and diesel for cars. Scientist database also includes 40,000 branded food items, and they said that future research could allow people to cut their food emissions by swapping brands. The study analyzing the costs of different diets was published in the journal The Lancet Planetary Health. It compared 7 sustainable diets to the current typical diet in 150 countries using food prices from the World Bank. It found that in high-income countries, vegan diets were the most affordable, reducing food costs by 21% to 34% compared to the average diet, depending on specific food choices. Vegetarian diets were a close second, with 27% to 31% reduction in food costs. Flexitarian diet with low amounts of meat and dairy products reduced costs by up to 14%, but fish-based pescatarian diets actually increased costs by 2%. The study focused on whole foods and did not include highly processed meat replacements or eating at restaurants or takeaways. Marco Springman from the University of Oxford, who led the second study, said, "We think that the fact that vegan, vegetarian, and flexitarian diets can save you a lot of money is going to surprise people," he added. "When scientists like me advocate for healthy and environmentally friendly eating, it's often said that we're sitting in our ivory towers promoting something that is financially out of reach for most people. This study shows that it's quite the opposite. These diets could be better for you, for your bank balance, as well as for your health and the health of the planet." The recent survey from the World Wildlife Fund found that more than 70% of Britons believe people should eat food that was better for the environment, but 65% said sustainable options were too expensive. Current average diets in rich nations do not align with nutritional guidelines, with meat eating higher than the recommended levels. Both the new studies confirm previous work that healthy diets are also lower emission diets. the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you, Rasulullah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to your program Like Muhammad with me, Javed Akbari. There is a hadith from the Holy Prophet who says, "Ad-dunya sijnul mu'min." The world is a prison for the believer. This hadith is a hadith which suggests that the world is not a place where a person can live at rest, or he can live a life of comfort and complete luxury. You know, dunya itself, if you look at the word dunya literally means something which is mean, which is low, which is base. So it's another name for this world, the world which we live, and this is a transient world. And this world has been rightly named dunya. Dunya means a low and a base place. So this world is a sijin, is a prison for the believer. The believer wishes, a true believer, of course, wishes to leave this world for the next world, because he knows what the next world is. He knows that prosperity, happiness, and well-being is to be found in the next world. This world is a world full of vicissitude, full of hardship. But what are we supposed to do, even if we know that this world is a world full of vicissitude? The fact of the matter is that you shouldn't grieve over the vicissitudes of your existence. You cannot escape hardship. Hardship is a part and parcel of this world, of the life in this world. Life, for most part, involves work and responsibility. It involves physical hardship. It involves difficulty and tribulation, trial and tribulation. In fact, happiness is an exception or only a fleeting phase that comes and goes sporadically. You long for this life, yet Allah does not want it to be a permanent abode for His righteous slaves. And as I said, this world is transient. It's not a permanent abode for the righteous person. No one says, no true believer says this world is a permanent abode. And no one can have such a belief. Even non-Muslims, even those who are atheists, they cannot claim that this world is a permanent abode. Because we see with our own eyes on a daily basis that people die and new people are born. And of course, this cycle continues. Let's have a short break, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome back. This is Like Muhammad from IRIB English Radio. Those who are born to this world, they are people who are newly born. They are not the same people who died, of course. We don't believe in reincarnation or something like that, as some religions might believe. Now, coming back to the main point, if this world were not a place of trial, of hardship, of tribulation, it would have been free from disease and free from hardship. It would have been a comfortable abode for the best of men, the messengers of God and the prophets, and from Adam to the last prophet, the prophet of Allah, peace be upon him and his family. We see that, of course, all those messengers suffered, they faced difficulties and troubles until the day they left. The prophets' lives were full of hardship, were replete with sadness, with grief, with hardship and difficulty. I give you the example of Noah. Noah's own people scoffed and ridiculed him. Ibrahim alayhi salatu wasalam was tested by the fire and by the command of slaughtering his son. That the story of Ibrahim is clear. It is depicted in the Holy Quran. Yaqub alayhi salatu wasalam was separated from his son and wept until he lost his sight. Musa, the prophet Moses alayhi salatu wasalam, endured the tyranny of Fir'aun and afterwards the disobedience of his own people. The story of Moses is also very clear. The story of the cow, the story of the people leaving the right path. It was prophet Moses who suffered a lot. Now, Jesus, prophet Isa alayhi salatu wasalam, was poor and of course he also suffered in his life in his own way, of course. And the last prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, patiently endured poverty and impudence of his people. And as I said in one of the previous episodes, the Prophet, peace be upon him, especially when he lived in Taif, he suffered at the hands of the people who did not believe him, who did not accept his invitation, who threw dirt and stone at him, causing him injury and fighting him. So the prophets did not leave happy lives in this world. We will come back with the continuation of the program. last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, when he lost Hamza, his uncle, he suffered a lot. He cried at the death of his uncle, Hamza alayhi salatu wasalam. I can give you the example of Shu'aib. Prophet Shu'aib also suffered a lot, and Prophet Zakaria was killed by his people, you know. And the story about Zakaria is very frightening, very shocking. Maybe you may not know what happened to Zakaria. Zakaria was chased by his own people. He was sawed to death, and all the prophets suffered, you know. If this world were a world of comfort and happiness, the prophets, who were the closest people to God, and no one is as close to the prophet as the prophets were, so they would have enjoyed the world, this life, and they wouldn't have suffered. But we see that they suffered most, and they suffered more than anyone else suffered on this planet. So in a literal sense, there are countless examples of the righteous people, the scholars, and the truthful being who suffered a lot, and who were imprisoned for their beliefs, and who were tortured. I can give you the example of our Imams, peace be upon them, from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, how much he suffered in his lifetime, and how much he suffered at the hands of those ignorant people, and Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam, and more importantly, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, how mercilessly Imam Hussein was killed on the land of Karbala by a few, you know, thugs, a few criminals who were ordered by Yazid to stop him and his family. And Imam Hussein was, alayhi salatu wasalam, was the closest man and the most noble individual on earth, but he was stopped on the land of Karbala, and he was killed mercilessly, ruthlessly, and brutally by those people, as we know the story well. That's all for this session. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave.
We give people.
Brutal brutes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll speak about police brutality, which has become synonymous with police action in the U.S. Every single year, more than 1,000 Americans die at the hands of police, and the numbers only seem to be rising. This week, we have two distinguished guests on our program, Gerald Horn, who is a professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, and Life Malcolm, who is a community organizer. Please stay with us.
Statistics show that the trend of fatal police shootings in the U.S. seems to only be increasing, with a total of 716 civilians having been shot, 111 of whom were black, as of October 2021. In 2020, there were 1,021 fatal police shootings, and in 2019, there were 999. Additionally, the rate of fatal police shootings among black Americans was much higher than that for any other ethnicity, standing at 37 fatal shootings per million of the population as of October 2021.
And now, based on research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America, police violence is a leading cause of death for young men in the U.S. Over a life course, about one in every 1,000 black men can expect to be killed by police. Professor Horn explains the state of police brutality in America a year after the murder of George Floyd.
You may recall that after the killing of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department in the late spring of 2020, there were massive demonstrations, not only in the United States, but around the world, because of the police terror inflicted upon black people. By some measures, these represented the largest demonstrations in the history of the United States of America. And as a result, we expected serious change to ensue. But that change has not come as of yet. In fact, there has been a backlash against change. You may have seen the results of the elections that took place in the United States on the first Tuesday of November of 2021. And you may also have noticed that many politicians were elected who are opposed to any change in police practices. This suggests that going forward, the road will be rocky indeed.
Black men are about 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than are white men. Black people who are fatally shot by police seem to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Latino, American Indian, and Alaskan Native men and women are also significantly more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts. Mr. Malcolm tells us if anything has improved more than a year after George Floyd's death.
No, nothing has improved regarding police brutality in the U.S. since George Floyd. It's likely worsened, if there is such a thing. It's always been extreme violence and extreme terror at the hands of police when it comes to African people and other colonized people in the U.S. You know, the George Floyd murder happened to be one of the most brutal instances of police violence captured on video, maybe since the Rodney King beating in the early 1990s in this country. And so everybody had an opportunity to, you know, when I say everybody, I mean people all around the world had the opportunity to witness the extreme violence and police terror that police heap upon the heads of ordinary Africans in this country every day.
Information from more than 2 million 911 calls in two U.S. cities reveals that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fired their guns 5 times more than black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhood. So what is the role of race when it comes to police violence?
In the United States, overwhelmingly and disproportionately, the victims of police terror happen to be black. Many of us see this as the legacy of slavery. You know that in the United States and North America, there has been enslavement of African people longer than there has been freedom for African people. Enslavement of African people for 300 years or more, freedom, quote unquote, for a period since 1865.
In many states, a Bill of Rights for law enforcement officers shields personnel from investigation into misconduct. Even officers who are fired for misconduct are frequently rehired. The New York Times reported in 2015 that the police officer in Cleveland, Ohio, who fatally shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice in 2014, had previously resigned from another police department after it had deemed him unfit to serve. The Cleveland police did not review the officer's personnel file before hiring him.
We're intelligent people who are colonized don't fight and struggle against racism. We all who are colonized in this world by white people, the role that racism plays in police brutality is to distract colonized people from the real struggle, which is that against colonialism, the fight for power, the fight for land, the fight for territory, the fight for freedom.
After many incidents in which police used brute force against unarmed African Americans, it seemed that people were fed up once they watched exactly how police officer Derek Chauvin planted a knee in the back of the neck of George Floyd for over 9.5 minutes and killed him, all the while he pleaded that he cannot breathe. The question one might ask is that are American police more violent in general?
I think that the figures show that the United States is one of the most violent nations on planet Earth. I see this as a legacy of how the nation was created. It was created by a violent seizure of the land from the indigenous population, a liquidation of a good deal of the indigenous population, and then kidnapping Africans with violence and bringing them to these shores to work for free for hundreds of years. That led to slave revolts that were repressed with bloodshed. And this is the culture that has been bequeathed to us today.
Thousands started protests and riots across America and later all around the world against police violence. The protesters demanded the defunding of the police, prosecution of the officers involved, and a dramatic change in law enforcement procedure, law, police recruitment, and to dismantle the systems of mass criminalization and incarceration. In light of these protests, what has the U.S. government done to decrease police violence?
The only thing that the American government, the United States government, has done for police brutality is give the brutal police more money almost in every city and every state in this country. Each year, the police budget increases. The numbers, the headcount on the police force increases. And of course, the brutality of the police increased. So if the United States government has done anything to that affects police brutality, it's give them more money for more guns and more terroristic tactics.
This is why, according to a report published in 2020, police budgets continue to be consistent across diverse geographies and cities in America, with up to 20 to 45% of discretionary funds allocated to the violent system.
After Reconstruction, the slave patrols morphed into local police departments, determined to enforce Jim Crow laws to control black people. Police unions really began consolidating power in the 1950s, in response to activists pushing for police reform. Fighting against oversight and advocating fiercely for their own ranks, they developed strict rules that remain in place for most police forces today. Police power continued to expand after the 1960s civil rights movement. The 1965 Law Enforcement Assistance Act, part of President Johnson's administration's war on crime, paved the way for militarization and funding by increasing federal involvement in local policing through grants. The support for local law enforcement from the federal government continued to grow, with a series of laws passed under subsequent presidents, from Reagan to Trump, that further aligned police departments with the military and perpetuated funding.
Center for Popular Democracy Action released newly updated data from their 2017 Freedom to Thrive report. The updated data exemplified much of what is already known to be true. The police continue to receive an astronomical percentage of discretionary funds compared to resources that actually keep communities safe. All of the police budgets analyzed in the report have increased since 2017.
Certainly under Mr. Trump, the police were out of control. The U.S. Justice Department, which has central authority over the so-called criminal justice system, basically went asleep under Mr. Trump between 2016 and his defeat in 2020.
Also, police reform movements largely failed on ballots across the nation, but one Black Lives Matter activist running on a defund the police platform won a seat and became the youngest member of the Des Moines, Iowa City Council.
The Black Lives Matter movement has given so-called officials an out, an escape. It allows these so-called officials to appear to be friends of African and other colonized people in something in the U.S. by adopting this pop slogan, you know. But the reality is, Joseph Robinette Biden, who is the same white man who put 100,000 or so police on the street that do the brutality to African people you and I are discussing right now, all the time. That same Joseph Robinette Biden, who is the puppet master of the police, can say Black Lives Matter. You know, even you know, some police will say Black Lives Matter, and at the same time shoot Black lives down.
In Minneapolis, where Floyd was killed by a police officer last year, voters rejected a citywide ballot measure, also known as Question 2, to overhaul the city's police department by replacing it with a new agency that would take a public health approach to law enforcement. Five council members who backed the initiative were ousted from their seat. And in Seattle, a city that saw extended protests in the wake of Floyd's death, Republican Ann Davison won over the former public defender and police and jail abolitionist Nicole Thomas Kennedy to become the new Seattle city attorney. So what can be done to stop the violence, discrimination, and abuse?
We have to be courageous enough to fight back. There's no other way. You know, Malcolm X said it best. When the white man has his flag, we have our flag. When the white man has his army, we have our army. When the white man has his gun, we have our gun. And we just have to be intelligent, organize, create, and build dual and contending power. And last, certainly not least, most of all, make a revolution. And that means overturn this nasty, stinking, foul social system, colonial capitalism, and bring into existence a socialist world under the leadership of the African working class.
The recent city elections illustrate the racist views held by many in law enforcement runs deeper than the police departments and prisons. Racism is a disease that many citizens of the United States possess and therefore do not vote for public officials who intend to reform police departments, and decries the systematic racism and brutality in these areas. Let's check in with Abbas Montagem to see what he has for us.
Peace and welcome back to Power to the People. On our last segment of Power to the People, we discussed how the United States is a settler colonial regime. Just to give you all a quick refresher, settler colonialism is when a non-native people, in the case of America, Europeans, came to the indigenous people's lands and set up political, economic, military, and social rule. They established a permanent population, and at the same time they was doing that, they displaced the indigenous people, right? Then at the same time they was doing that, they was enslaving us, African people, right? We must fundamentally understand that settler colonialism is genocidal. It is, point blank period, it is genocidal. On October 22nd, a group called the In Spirit of the Mandela Coalition found the United States guilty of genocide. Guilty of genocide. As African peoples, as indigenous peoples, as brown people, we have understand through ancestral knowledge, through the knowledge passed down through our elders, through being students of the Black radical tradition, that our experience on this land called America is genocidal, right? And this tribunal successfully charged the United States guilty with genocide, right? So to begin to understanding genocide, we have to understand the United Nations definition of genocide. United Nations, in the present convention, genocide may be any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part amongst national lines, ethnic lines, racial lines, religious groups, right? And some of these components of genocide are one, killing members of a group, two, causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group, three, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring apart its physical destruction in whole or in part. 4, imposing measures intended to prevent the births of a group. And 5, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. International jurists throughout the world came to Harlem, right? Came to the historic Audubon, in which El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X, was martyred, and picked up that torch in which Malcolm was calling for the international community to be aware of the human rights condition here in America, right? The jurists picked up the torch, right? The spirit of the Mandela Coalition picked up the torch and successfully charged genocide against the United States of America, right? They charged genocide amongst 5 specific charges. 1, the racist police killings of Black, Brown, and Indigenous people. 2, the hyper-incarceration of Black, Brown, and Indigenous people. 3, the political incarceration of civil rights, national liberation era revolutionaries, as well as current day activists. 4, the environmental racism and the impact on Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, right? 5, public health racism. All these charges together call for genocide. And that's what it is genocide. And the U.S. was found guilty of genocide, right? We understand our history. We know that African people have been murdered on this land, right? Through the transatlantic slave trade, it's estimated between 70 to 100 million of our people were murdered. And through slavery, were murdered, right? And it didn't end there. Through Jim Crow, there was lynchings, murders, right? We understand that the pigs, the police, right, kill us every day, right? The pigs kill us, the pigs incarcerate us, right? We have vigilantes like George Zimmerman murdering our children like Trayvon Martin, right? Emmett Till beat up, killed, murdered by white supremacists. This is what is genocide, right? The killing of our groups, the killing of the members of our groups, the killing of our new African nation, the killing of our Black nation, right? That is genocidal, right? We know that new African youth have been forced into foster care through this racist system of foster care, right? Taking our children from our people, from our house, and taking them elsewhere, right? We know that this has happened and has continued to happen, right? We know that Black, Brown, and indigenous women have been forcibly sterilized by this racist government, right? And through that, it affects the population from growing, right? We know that today, more Black men are under correctional control than were enslaved. We went from the slave plantation all the way to the prison plantation, right? These are genocidal acts that have been committed, and the jurists, right, after hearing hours and hours and hours of testimony over 2 days, found the U.S. guilty of genocide, right? So what does that mean now? Yes, this will be submitted to the United Nations. Yes, lawsuits will be filed, right? But we do not believe that the United Nations in itself will deploy troops, because we know that the UN has oftentimes been a proxy for American violence. It has not done anything to sanction the United States on the violence that it has committed, not only to Black, Brown, and Indigenous people on this land, but to Black, Brown, and Indigenous people throughout the world, right? So it's important that we document this history. We document this genocide. We must say we will never forget the African Holocaust that has occurred, right? The African genocide that has and continues to occur on this land. Right, and we must, as people who are struggling against imperialism, colonialism, we must call our position in this land as genocide. Because once we realize that is genocide, right, and once we understand that the U.S. is guilty of genocide, it puts the U.S. up there with the Adolf Hitlers of the world. And if we study Adolf Hitler, we know that Adolf Hitler learned about genocide from the United States of America, right? And it is our human right. We must understand that it is our human right to stop genocide against our people. The United Nations says that. The United Nations doesn't quote-unquote permit genocide, right? But genocide has been found, and now it is our human right to stop that genocide. So we must embody, as what Jalil Muti Kim says, we are our own liberators. We are our own liberators, and we must stop the genocide against Black, Brown, and Indigenous people. We must stop the genocide that the U.S. government commits every single day when it drops bombs in the Middle East, when it tries to steal the oil from Iran. That is genocidal. These sanctions is genocidal, right? So as people who are facing genocide, as African people facing genocide, it is our human right to stop this genocide. It is our human right to organize, to fight back, and to stop this genocide. we must embody the slogan, "We are only brothers." Power to the people.
Well, that was our show, everyone. I am your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next week on another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Leaving Sin. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of leaving sin. Now, this is very important that when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle, in our lifestyle, sin should not have any part in our lifestyle. We should leave it. It should not be the part of our life, because this is a sin that stops us from getting to perfection. Whereas the Islamic lifestyle and Islam has come to take us towards the perfection. Now, one of the biggest hurdles is sin itself. When we see a sin, it stops us from getting to perfection. It stops us from going to the right path. And it stops us from feeding the best thing to our soul. Because obviously, we have two things. We have a soul and a body. For the body, we have subsistence like, you know, fruits, food, and drinks. These are the things that we give to our body, and this body gets strengthened with this. Whereas on the other side, if I talk about the body first, so these are the foods that we give. On the for the body, there are some things which are not beneficial, basically. And that is, for example, if someone just eats junk food, if a person do not eat properly on time, if he's not eating on time, these are the things that are harmful for his body. Maybe he's eating too fat, and that is also harmful for his body. So we need to be very much careful. When we are very much careful about our body, similarly, we need to be careful about our soul. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the leaving the sins, and we talked about the body. We gave the example of body, that the way we give food to the body, there are something which are beneficial for the body, which help this body to gain or to have the growth, and there are some things which are harmful for the body, which we do not give, or we do not eat or drink such things. Similarly, we have a soul. This soul also needs some sustenance. There are many things that are harmful for the soul, and there are many things that are beneficial for the soul. There are the things that helps the soul to grow quickly and to reach to perfection, and there are many things that stop the soul from getting the perfection, and it is definitely harmful for the soul. Now, the things that are harmful for the soul, one of those things is sin itself. When a person commits a sin, the soul gets angry. Obviously, it weakens the soul. It brings a black dot on the heart of a person. Whereas if a person is performing good deeds, he never goes towards the sin, that person obviously achieves the perfection sooner. And we have many, many supplications in which we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive us. Even at the last sajda or the prostrate that we do, we say, ظَلَمْتُ نَفْسِي, I have done ظُلْم, unjust, I was unjust towards myself. فَغْفِرْ لِي, O Allah, forgive me. Why I was unjust? It was because of the sin that I committed. So the sin itself is injustice. The sin itself is oppression against my body and my soul. The sin itself is oppression. So we need to get rid of these sins, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EN.
In Britain, delays to the vaccination rollout mean some 12 to 15-year-olds may not get their COVID jab until February of next year, 15 weeks after the government's original target for offering the jab to all eligible teenagers, according to the Labour Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Sally Wheel and Dennis Campbell. The piece is titled, COVID jab wait for 12 to 15-year-olds in England could be up to 5 months. Britain, delays to the vaccination rollout mean that some 12 to 15-year-olds may not get their COVID jab until February of next year, 15 weeks after the government's original target for offering the jab to all eligible teenagers, according to the Labour Party. Officials originally set October half-term as a target to invite those in the age group to receive the vaccine in schools, after criticism that England was slow to approve it for children compared to other countries. New analysis by Labour Party suggests, however, that if the vaccine